This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After 18 and a half years and the longest economic expansion in American history, the end has finally come. Today is the last day on the job as chairman of the Federal Reserve for Alan Greenspan. He's been called the Michael Jordan, the Lance Armstrong, the Garry Kasparov of central bankers. He leaves behind an economy of strong growth, low inflation, low unemployment. But a cover of The Economist magazine this month shows Alan Greenspan in tracksuit handing off a stick of dynamite to his successor, Ben Bernanke, with a short and burning fuse of huge deficits and giant American indebtedness. Up next on Point, the Greenspan-Bernanke handoff and the way ahead for the U.S. economy. We begin in Washington with Greg Ipp, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Greg, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
So give us the straight numbers first, Greg. Where do we stand in the march of the Fed chief's work right now? Greenspan has been pushing interest rates up for a long time. Are we finished with that or more to come?
Excellent question, Tom. It's what Wall Street really wants to know. Back in June of 2004, when the Fed's interest rate was only 1%, they embarked on this program now to bring it back to a more normal level. And that's what they've been doing. For today, I think they'll make it 14 straight meetings of quarter-point increases, and that should bring the rate up to 4.5%. But where do we go from here? That's a big question. Now that the rate is in more of a normal range, a level that's not so low that it's stimulating spending or so high that it's holding the economy back, it's not clear what they will do next. And in fact, the statement that they give us after the meeting may in fact give us quite a bit less certainty about that going forward.
Greenspan took the rate very low in order to guard against deflation, the kind that Japan saw in the 1990s. What are the risk factors now that would determine a consideration of interest rates up or down on mortgages and loans and everything else ultimately?
The risk factors are actually quite finely balanced. I mean, if the economy were like really weak, then it would be obvious that you would probably want to pause here and think about the time you'd want to cut rates. Or if inflation were bursting up well above 2%, headed toward 3%, you'd also probably want to think about raising rates some more. But neither of those things are happening. The economy looks reasonably solid, and inflation looks like it's under control. Now, it's true that we had a very weak quarter of growth in the fourth quarter of last year, but there were a lot of factors involved in that that appear to be temporary, and most economists think that we're going to bounce back very nicely in the current quarter. So again, the way forward is really not obvious at this point, and that's actually the first time we could say that for the last 2 years.
Is there anything then in Alan Greenspan's successor Ben Bernanke's instincts or record or published trail that might give us a clue as to whether he's likely to be more open-handed or more tight with interest rates?
I don't think there is. The odd thing is that although we know Bernanke is a much more open and transparent person who doesn't use the same opacity and imprecision that Greenspan does when he speaks, there's nothing to suggest that he's going to be any more candid about what he's going to do next. I mean, I watched the man for 3 years when he was a Federal Reserve governor. I never saw him give any broad hints about what the Fed was going to do next with interest rates that we didn't already know. So I think that while he will be more clear, that doesn't necessarily mean he'll be more substantive in what he tells us. He appears before Congress on February 15th and February 16th, and at that point he'll be 6 weeks away from his next policy meeting, and I'd be surprised if he gives us strong hints about what he intends to do then, because so much more information will come out in the interim.
Federal Reserve chairmanship handoffs have seen some rocky moments before. Alan Greenspan had the 1987 stock crash just a couple of months after he got it. Is Ben Bernanke, I mean, no one knows, obviously, but do the markets or anything else indicate that he may be up against some trial by fire soon?
It's certainly possible. In fact, almost every cycle of the Fed raising interest rates does bring about some kind of a financial crisis. As you mentioned, in 1987, we had the stock market crash. Going back to 1979 to 81, with Paul Volcker's anti-inflation program, we had the third world debt crisis. Going back more recently to 94, we had the tequila crisis when Mexico came close to defaulting on its debts. So yes, Fed tightenings do often bring about some kind of event. And if one were to look around now, you'd say the likeliest candidates are a problem in the housing market because housing prices are so high, or a problem with the dollar because we have this very large trade deficit. On the other hand, as Greenspan likes to say, if you can predict a crisis, you're pretty sure it won't going to happen because whatever it is you predicted, you'll take steps to avoid. So whatever hits us is probably going to be unexpected.
Greg, what about the logistics and maybe even the emotion of the handoff today? What exactly happens? Does Alan Greenspan have a moment where when he walks out the door and that's it?
I think that, yeah, I don't know for sure. I suspect he turns the lights off and leaves at the end of the day, and tomorrow Mr. Bernanke starts moving in. There'll probably be some formal goodbyes and so on here. But the transition has been remarkably smooth. I mean, you'd have to say that given the fireworks we've seen on the Supreme Court, this is pretty dull stuff as far as Washington goes. President Bush chose a very qualified and uncontroversial individual to follow Alan Greenspan, and so we've seen nary a ripple either in the political class or in the financial markets accompanying this event.
So the market's sort of steady as she goes as Ben Bernanke approaches the steering wheel.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember, Tom, that even though we've all written accolades about how well the economy has done under Alan Greenspan, that it's not necessarily the case that it was thanks to some sort of magical formula that only he had. If you look around the world, most countries have actually done quite well for the last 10 to 15 years, not just the United States. Whatever it is, the Fed's been doing well. Other central banks have figured it out as well. And Bernanke is very familiar with all the basic tools and training that central bankers have learned over the last 20 to 30 years. He may not be the same mythical figure that Greenspan was, but odds are that he'll probably do a pretty good job.
Greg, it's been great talking with you in the Greenspan era. We look forward to having you back in the Bernanke era.
And I look forward to being back, Tom.
Greg Ipp, economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. We are talking about the Greenspan-Bernanke handoff and the economic outlook facing the new Fed chief. You can join the conversation. What is in the basket that Alan Greenspan is handing Ben Bernanke today? A thriving U.S. economy or a load of trouble to come? And has Greenspan been a genius or is there a bill to come due on Bernanke's watch? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Philadelphia, just back from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, is Jeremy Siegel. He is professor of finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and author of The Future for Investors, Why the Tried and True Triumph. Jeremy Siegel, welcome back to On Point.
Happy to be here, Tom.
And with us from New York is James Grant, editor of Grant's Interest Rate Observer, a publication on the financial markets. He's a columnist at Forbes magazine and author of The Trouble with Prosperity. Yes, he's the one who's called Alan Greenspan the Wizard of Oz. James Grant, thanks for joining us.
It's nice to be here, Tom.
Jeremy Siegel, first to you. Here we are with this huge handoff moment. You can't have much bigger figure. He's been around so long, 18 and a half years, Alan Greenspan. And we see the laudatory comments from all kinds of angles, and yet there's that cover of The Economist magazine showing Alan Greenspan in a tracksuit handing off not a baton but a stick of dynamite to Ben Bernanke. What do you think he's bequeathing his successor?
Well, he is passing the baton at a critical juncture. I mean, as Greg mentioned, we have an increase today, but it's a big question going forward. We've had two bubbles to deal with, one in commodities and one in housing. Housing seems to be cooling a little bit. There's some fear it's going to cool too much and send us into a recession. The commodities boom looked like it was quieting down after Katrina, but it's bounced back again. So
when you say commodities, most people would think stock market. Oil.
Commodities, I'm thinking of oil, and mm-hmm. I'm thinking of oil, gold, copper, aluminum. There's really mm-hmm. been a commodities boom, which is an inflationary threat. So Greenspan is passing that baton at a very critical, difficult juncture. Ben has not an easy initiation into his role as Fed chairman.
So there's three booms or bubbles. We look back on the dot-com bubble, now maybe housing and maybe commodities, oil, gold, and the rest. James Grant, some of this can't be avoided. Some of it could be traced back to Alan Greenspan's leadership. What marks do you give him on the kind of deep foundation he's leaving behind for Ben Bernanke and the rest of us?
He has certainly proven that the U.S. economy, like Major League Baseball, is indestructible, and we must give him that. I think we ought to call the thing by its name. Alan Greenspan is in the business of price fixing, which is an unholy business. Recall the bad old days in which the federal government fixed airfares, rail freight rates, the price of corn, New York City fixed rents.
He's supposed to fix the interest rate. Is there something else he's fixing?
Exactly. He is in the business of fixing an interest rate. The question that is not asked ever, except in a furtive and unauthorized way, is why the Federal Reserve is in the business of fixing a rate, and how does it know what that rate should be? People contend that Alan Greenspan has the capacity to look into the future and improve it before it can happen by dint of fixing the right rate. And as the French would say, it's all very well in practice, but what is the theory? And the theory is wholly implausible. Sooner or later, these guys are going to get the wrong rate. I think it's already happened. But we ought to at least, Jeremy, you and me, acknowledge that the Federal Reserve is principally in the business of fixing a rate. Which rate might be determined also in the marketplace?
Steve's calling from Plum Island, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Your previous guest made a comment about how, in spite of the slow growth in the fourth quarter, we should expect a bounce back.
Yes, it was down at 1-point-something growth, away from the 3.5 or something for the year. Yeah?
Yeah, and I guess I'm taking a more pessimistic view because I look at the price of propane or fuel oil or especially gasoline, mm-hmm. which I see an inelastic demand. And I see, you know, money being spent on those items and money not being available to spend on other goods. So I think it's kind of pessimistic in terms of the long term because energy is going to be a big cost for all of us.
And do you leave that in Alan Greenspan's lap, or is that, like so many things, the result of bigger factors than even an 18-and-a-half-year Fed chairman?
Well, it's part of the economy, so I guess I put it on Alan Greenspan's hat. We seem to put all good things on his lap. Let's put some of the bad things on his lap, too.
Steve, thanks for calling. James Grant, what about the commodities surging prices? Jeremy Siegel was pointing to them, and our caller Steve says, how are we going to get back to big growth if we've got these rocketing commodity prices, oil in particular?
The great commodities boom, I think, is on balance the result of the annexation of India and China to the world economy. You know, hundreds of millions of people who heretofore had not had had much money to spend now do, and not only have some money but also aspirations. So that is a great and good thing for humanity. Mm. Yet there is also what they say in the trade, a monetary dimension to this all. The U.S. consumes much more than it produces. And to pay for these goods and services, it emits floods of dollars into the world's payments system, like $700 billion a year or thereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
And other Alan Greenspans in the world, the central banks in Asia, absorb these dollars. Now, how do they pay for them? Well, they pay for them with local currency that they print for the very purpose. So the Chinese print renminbi and the Koreans print yuan. So there is a great issuing of money globally. Now, a lot of money tends to find mischief to do, and this money has tended to bid up the prices of commodities. So the price of commodities would probably be going up anyway, thanks to the new prosperity in China and India, but I think they're going up a lot more than that on account of reckless monetary policies the world over.
Jeremy Siegel, I want to go straight to this issue of Alan Greenspan's legacy when it comes to monetary policy. The Economist, with the burning stick of dynamite on its cover, says that he essentially had a cheap money policy throughout, you know, up and down, but on balance, cheap money. And that, given the world economic circumstances, funneled into asset prices, first in the stock market, now in housing. And then that allowed consumers to borrow against the increased value of their homes, driving this negative personal savings rate that we now see, and this huge household debt and huge current account deficits. The Economist compares Greenspan's policy in that way to burning the furniture to heat the house. Do you see it that way?
No, I don't, Tom. One of the aspects of the stock market bubble, first of all, it was almost entirely in the tech sector, the dot-com. Actually, outside of that sector, we're back to the levels that we were in 2000, and actually well above the levels when Greenspan uttered irrational exuberance in December of 96. And then he backed away, and I think in some ways, yes, it came back with a vengeance in dot-com in 99, sort of a bubble on that rise. But we also had important is when people get faith in a central banker being able to control the business cycle, mm-hmm. that will cause in and of itself a rise in stock prices. So in a way, you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't. People say he could have prevented the bubble by stabilizing the economy even more, but that would have driven people even more into stocks. That's what happened in the 1920s when people thought that continuous prosperity was always there. So with markets, you have a very interesting feedback mechanism. And let me say on the housing bubble, and here I really think The Economist is really quite wrong. We have a bubble in housing that's worldwide. In fact, as I attended several sessions at the World Economic Forum
in Davos.
More than half of the countries have actually had bigger rises over the last 5 years than the United States. It's not just Greenspan, pushing down U.S. interest rates. What we have is the fact that worldwide interest rates are down, and this is due to tremendous savings by most China, Asian countries in particular, that's depressing rate and several other special factors, and a tremendous increase in the demand for housing, and baby boomers buying second and third. Mm-hmm. And this is, again, a worldwide phenomenon. So to say that we're going to put the blame at the feet of Alan Greenspan, I think is wholly unfair.
James Grant, how about it? You note that when Greenspan took office in 87, the United States was a net creditor, small but still a creditor to the rest of the world. Now it's a giant net debtor that since 87, combined consumer, business, and government debt has vaulted to 306% of the gross domestic product. That's way up there. The trade deficit last year, maybe $760 billion, up 80% from the first year Bush was in office. What about the Economist's charge that Alan Greenspan has burnt the furniture to heat the house of the American economy?
Someone has. I agree with Jeremy that one can impute too much for good or ill to the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Bubbles, booms, busts, antedate the institution of central banking. In any case, there was a great localized housing bubble in, of all places, the Great Plains in the 1880s, and before Alan Greenspan was like in college even. So we can't, he shouldn't be on Mount Rushmore, nor necessarily should he be consigned to the inner circles of hell. Having said that, he has presided, perhaps sometimes inadvertently, other times not so inadvertently, over a terrific expansion of debt, and he has kind of cheered it all on. Now, let me try to defend that.
Mm-hmm.
People say that Alan Greenspan uttered the words irrational exuberance, as if he could see into the future. He stopped saying it, and then, moreover, he began saying that we are embarked on a new era. He sounded more like Henry Blodgett than Henry Blodgett did by the time the top came in the year 2000.
So in 96, the note of caution, but then kind of pedal to the metal right along with the dot-com cheerleaders.
He certainly did, and he is this most dangerous of public servants. He wants to be liked.
But why shouldn't we like? I mean, we liked the run-up. People liked the housing bubble, at least while it lasted, and the stock market.
Well, famously, Tom, central bankers are charged with the disagreeable job of removing the punch bowl just when the party's getting good. And Greenspan more than once has actually spiked it. In early 2003, he all but urged the American public to take out adjustable rate mortgages.
The Economist says he encouraged, his policies have encouraged drunk and disorderly asset markets and intoxicated consumers. Is there a bill to pay for Ben Bernanke coming in here, James Grant?
Well, sure. And you can see or hear the shifting of the global marketplace now. The price of gold is a pretty good indicator of the world's faith in the institution of the dollar.
What's it up to these days?
More broadly, of paper money. And the price of gold is going up against all currencies.
Right.
Alan Greenspan played the game of central banker and excelled at it at a time, if it were a tennis game, when there was no net. The dollar is purely faith-based. There's nothing behind it. There's no collateral. You can't go to the Treasury and say, here are 35 singles. I would like, please, an ounce of gold. That ended in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
So under the Greenspan era, the world has absorbed literally hundreds of billions of dollars a year, and it has invested them with confidence. Now, the new fellow, Ben Bernanke, famously or infamously, in the year 2002, said, you know, the U.S. government has a tool. It's called the printing press. We can print as many dollars as we want. And furthermore, he said, professorially, like, he said, we could, and this is an image that Milton Friedman popularized, we could drop them out of helicopters, thereby forestalling deflation.
Right. No deflation. We'll just shower cash on the country.
Yeah. And he hates to be called Helicopter Ben, but you know what? Helicopter Ben, he is.
And yet, if it works, Americans have liked it. The question is, what are we into long-term here? Let me take another call. Mark is calling from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Hi, Mark. You're on the air. Hello, Mark. Are you there, my friend?
Yes, I am.
What do you think, Mark? What do you see?
Well, I think the system's broken. And I've been a stockbroker and been a part of management for stockbrokerage firms for the better part of the last 30 years. And I've watched with interest when Volcker came in and the changes that were made in monetary policy at that point in time, his work with Reagan and what ended up really creating what I think has been this incredible economy that we have enjoyed since that point in time.
So what's broken now, Mark?
What's broken is I don't think we need a Federal Reserve that sets rates. We have extraordinarily efficient markets in place. The only time the Fed really needs to step up is when we have a liquidity problem that may surface in the marketplace because of a long-term holdings or some other kind of a real critical problem that steps up.
But you think the market is so ingenious naturally that it would steer us away from a Great Depression, from a collapse, from a problem? We can't be smarter than the market at all?
Well, let's put it this way. Do I think that an Alan Greenspan by himself is the sage that's going to be all wise and all knowing to be able to keep us from having those problems? No, I don't think so. My personal position is this. Stock and bond markets are extraordinarily efficient. Supply-demand issues will always crop up in all of these things, and quite frankly, the markets themselves take care of themselves. The dot-com problem that existed during that period, that entire run-up that occurred, and the subsequent bubble that burst because of Mr. Greenspan was going to burst anyway. It didn't need Mr. Greenspan to basically blow it up. It was going to do it on its own.
So he put a nice label on it, irrational exuberance,
The irrational exuberance was already understood by the market as people were watching stocks that went from zero to 400 with never a dollar of earnings. Eventually, we're going to get taken down, and that was obvious, and it was obvious to everybody who was in the market.
Mark, let us look at this, and thanks for your call. Jeremy Siegel, here it is again. James Grant says, kind of, who needs a Fed chief? Mark chimes in and says, yeah, let the market set rates. I think most Americans see it as a comforting notion that you've got a wise sage eye on the world, adjusting those rates, keeping ahead of the game. Is it irrelevant? Is it even, unnecessary?
No, I think it is very comforting to have a central bank there controlling. We, teach in monetary theory and policy, you either control the rate or you control the supply of money and let rates go where they will. It's one or the other, or some combination of both. But central banks around the world have migrated to saying the short-term rate is a very efficient way of providing liquidity and smoothing out business cycles. And even Milton Friedman, who had argued for so many years, don't control those short-term rates, just supply money at a 3% per year even rate, has recently said the Fed, by watching inflation and other factors, has done well with its short-term interest rate policy. So I think we are there. Every central bank in the world virtually does set a short-term interest rate, and I don't think we're moving away from there. I would like to talk to your point, Tom, about some of those legacies of debt.
Mm-hmm.
There's really two aspects. One is the government debt and deficit. And here, believe it or not, we don't stand that badly. The European Central Bank set as its provisions to join the monetary union that you don't have a government budget deficit more than 3% of GDP, and
right.
You don't have debt more than 60%. And believe it or not, the U.S. is somewhat in that zone today, actually in better shape than many of the European countries who have been breaking out of of that zone. On the trade front, there's something that we are very, very extreme. But is that Alan Greenspan's fault? If you want to lay the cause of that, I think it's China and other Asian countries saying, hey, listen, I want to export to you, and I'll accept dollars, as many as you give me, and we're making that bargain. I think it's a good bargain for us. I think it's ultimately a bad bargain for them. But as long as they're supplying us with all these cheap goods, holding down our inflation rate, I think we would be foolish not to accept it.
Right now, Sue is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, thanks. What do you think, Sue?
Well, I'm calling to ask if anyone is concerned about the fact that when governments are able to print up money at will, eventually they get into an awful lot of trouble, as what happened in, say, Revolutionary France. Historically, fiat money has turned out to be a bad thing.
The U.S. government's been printing it at will for a long time. So far, so good generally, don't you think, Sue?
I don't know. Compared to when I was a child, a chunky used to cost 5 cents. And now that same candy bar is smaller and costs probably 69 cents.
Let us pick it up. Sue, thanks for your call, James Grant. Sue wants her nickel chunky back.
And
maybe the gold standard.
Well, the gold standard was a pretty fine system. Now, the truth of the matter is that none of these systems is forever. The classical gold standard was basically from 1880 to 1914, and it died in the trenches in World War I, and then came a kind of a roadshow gold standard in the 20s and the 30s, and that too went to its rewards. In 1946 or thereabouts came so-called Bretton Woods, and the dollar was made convertible into gold at $35 per ounce, and that ended in 1971. And since 71, we have been on the improvisational standard, in which, as Sue points out, there are as many dollars printed as the world seems to want. And I couldn't agree with her more that history is absolutely conclusive in its judgment about fiat money, that is, paper money without collateral. That is, it goes to zero.
Sure.
Absolutely. The great question, of course, is when. Another great question, which Jeremy Siegel answers so well in his books, is what do you do about it? But there can be no argument about the fate of uncollateralized or unsecured paper money. That's pure paper money. It always goes to zero.
Jeremy Siegel, look at that with us for a second. And in this context, if you would, everybody says that this now negative U.S. savings rate cannot go on. We cannot be in debt to Asia and the rest of the world forever. One way out of that might be to inflate the way out of some of that debt, to cheapen the debt, in effect, through inflation. Is there going to be a huge temptation or almost a mandate at some point, maybe under Ben Bernanke's watch, to try that? Is that a risk in the unbacked paper money era that we're in?
Well, I have far more faith, I think, than Jim in the fiat money system. The gold standard just proved to be far too restrictive, and most historians, Ben Bernanke included, Milton Friedman and others, showed that too strict adherence to it was one of the causes why the Great Depression occurred, and we didn't have flexibility at supplying reserves because we didn't have enough gold. In fact, we were losing gold. But fiat money can be abused. The whole world and the United States went through an inflationary period in the 70s, but we learned a lesson from that. We learned that we have to all be watching inflation. I think there's two major lessons that we've learned about central banking in the last 100 years. One was how to prevent a collapse of the financial system, such as the Great Depression, by providing liquidity when needed. And the second is how to prevent inflation by moving interest rates up as soon as that becomes a threat. And I think the world, as central bankers, have been sensitized to inflation to such an extent that they will raise rates as much as necessary, because that is far more important than helping the government out. Now, that being said, Tom, your question, right, if we politicize the Fed, if the Fed gets taken over by Congress and, we have to run more debt, they can just tell the Fed, just print the money, forget about inflation. That's why the independence of the central bank is so critical to successful central banking and monetary policy.
So to swing the pendulum, I just want to ask, and our time is short, to swing the pendulum, what's going to have to happen? There's going to have to be a bullet bitten, maybe on Ben Bernanke's watch. What's it going to take, James Grant? We've just got a minute here.
So old am I I recall the days when people refused to buy 15% long-dated U.S. government securities because they knew that inflation was ineradicable. It was an institution of every social democracy. The Fed, in the face of it, was helpless. That was the state of knowledge and of certainty in 1981. Okay, years passed. Now what do people know? People know that central banks are the masters of their financial fates. They know that central banks have learned their lesson. They know that they are in control of inflation, and they buy bonds, indeed, without let or hindrance at 3%, 4%, 2%. So the world has already forgot. People don't learn lessons. They learn them, and then a lot the cycle turns, and they forget them. So we are, I believe, embarked on a new inflationary era. It began in 2003 when long-term yields got to 3% or so. The price of gold is climbing. Commodities are through the roof. It's happening. And even so astute an observer as Jeremy Siegel denies it. It's here.
And Ben Bernanke may have it in his lap, and he may have it in his lap today. I'm afraid with that, we're out of time. We'll have to come back and see just how that inflation ticker goes. I'm grateful to both of you, James Grant at Grant's Interest Rate Observer in New York. Mr. Grant, thank you for joining us.
You are welcome.
And Jeremy Siegel, professor of finance at the Wharton School, author of The Future for Investors, Why the Tried and True Triumph. Professor Siegel, thanks as always for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.